though not so much as might be supposed, for knowing Caddy to be safe in his hands, I often slipped home at about the hours when he was expected. We frequently met, notwithstanding. I was quite reconciled to myself now, but I still felt glad to think that he was sorry for me, and he still was sorry for me, I believed. He helped Mr. Badger in his professional engagements, which were numerous, and had as yet no settled projects for the future. It was when Caddy began to recover that I began to notice a change in my dear girl. I cannot say how it first presented itself to me, because I observed it in many slight particulars which were nothing in themselves, and only became something when they were pieced together. But I made it out, by putting them together, that Ada was not so frankly cheerful with me as she used to be. Her tenderness for me was as loving and true as ever. I did not for a moment doubt that. But there was a quiet sorrow about her which she did not confide to me, and in which I traced some hidden regret. Now I could not understand this, and I was so anxious for the happiness of my own pet that it caused me some uneasiness and set me thinking often. At length, feeling sure that Ada suppressed this something from me, lest it should make me unhappy too, it came into my head that she was a little grieved for me by what I had told her about Bleak House. How I persuaded myself that this was likely, I don't know. I had no idea that there was any selfish reference in my doing so. I was not grieved for myself. I was quite contented and quite happy. Still, that Ada might be thinking, for me, though I had abandoned all such thoughts, of what once was, but was now all changed, seemed so easy to believe that I believed it. What could I do to reassure my darling, I considered then, and show her that I had no such feelings? Well, I could only be as brisk and busy as possible, and that I had tried to be all along. However, as Caddy's illness had certainly interfered more or less with my home duties, though I had always been there in the morning to make my guardian's breakfast, and he had 100 times laughed and said there must be 2 little women, for his little woman was never missing, I resolved to be doubly diligent and gay. So I went about the house, humming all the tunes I knew, and I sat working and working in a desperate manner, and I talked and talked, morning, noon, and night. And still there was the same shade between me and my darling.
"So, Dame Trot," observed my guardian, shutting up his book one night when we were all 3 together, "so Woodcourt has restored Caddy Jellyby to the full enjoyment of life again."
"Yes," I said, "and to be repaid by such gratitude as hers is to be made rich, guardian."
"I wish it was," he returned, "with all my heart."
"So did I, too, for that matter. I said so."
"Aye. We would make him as rich as a Jew if we knew how. Would we not, little woman?"
I laughed as I worked, and replied that I was not sure about that, for it might spoil him, and he might not be so useful, and there might be many who could ill spare him, as Miss Flight and Caddy herself, and many others.
"True," said my guardian, "I had forgotten that. But we would agree to make him rich enough to live, I suppose. Rich enough to work with tolerable peace of mind, rich enough to have his own happy home and his own household gods, and household goddess, too, perhaps."
"That was quite another thing," I said. "We must all agree in that."
"To be sure," said my guardian, "all of us. I have a great regard for Woodcourt, a high esteem for him, and I have been sounding him delicately about his plans. It is difficult to offer aid to an independent man with that just kind of pride which he possesses, and yet I would be glad to do it if I might, or if I knew how. He seems half inclined for another voyage, but that appears like casting such a man away."
"It might open a new world to him," said I.
"So it might, little woman," my guardian assented. "I doubt if he expects much of the old world. Do you know, I fancy that he sometimes feels some particular disappointment or misfortune encountered in it. You never heard of anything of that sort?"
I shook my head.
Said my guardian. "I am mistaken, I dare say."
As there was a little pause here, which I thought, for my dear girl's satisfaction, had better be filled up, I hummed an air as I worked, which was a favourite with my guardian. "And do you think Mr. Woodcourt will make another voyage?" I asked him, when I had hummed it quietly all through.
"I don't quite know what to think, my dear, but I should say it was likely at present that he will give a long trial to another country."
"I'm sure he will take the best wishes of all our hearts with him wherever he goes," said I. "And though they are not riches, he will never be the poorer for them, guardian, at least."
"Never, little woman," he replied.
I was sitting in my usual place, which was now beside my guardian's chair. That had not been my usual place before the letter, but it was now. I looked up to Ada, who was sitting opposite, and I saw, as she looked at me, that her eyes were filled with tears, and that tears were falling down her face. I felt that I had only to be placid and merry once for all to undeceive my dear and set her loving heart at rest. I really was so, and I had nothing to do but to be myself. So I made my sweet girl lean upon my shoulder, how little thinking what was heavy on her mind, and I said she was not quite well, and put my arm about her, and took her upstairs. When we were in our own room, and when she might perhaps have told me what I was so unprepared to hear, I gave her no encouragement to confide in me. I never thought she stood in need of it.
"Ah, my dear, good Esther," said Ada, "if I could only make up my mind to speak to you and my cousin John when you are together."
"Why, my love," I remonstrated, "Ada, why should you not speak to us?" Ada only dropped her head and pressed me closer to her heart. "You surely don't forget, my beauty," said I, smiling, "what quiet, old-fashioned people we are, and how I have settled down to be the discreetest of dames. You don't forget how happily and peacefully my life is all marked out for me, and by whom. I'm certain that you don't forget by what a noble character, Ada. That can never be."
"No, never, Esther."
"Why then, my dear," said I, "there can be nothing amiss. And why should you not speak to us?"
"Nothing amiss, Esther," returned Ada. "Oh, when I think of all these years, and all his fatherly care and kindness, and of the old relations among us, and of you, what shall I do? What shall I do?"
I looked at my child in some wonder, but I thought it better not to answer otherwise than by cheering her, and so I turned off into many little recollections of our life together, and prevented her from saying more. When she lay down to sleep, and not before, I returned to my guardian to say good night, and then I came back to Ada and sat near her for a little while. She was asleep, and I thought, as I looked at her, that she was a little changed. I had thought so more than once lately. I could not decide, even looking at her while she was unconscious, how she was changed, but something in the familiar beauty of her face looked different to me. My guardian's old hopes of her and Richard arose sorrowfully in my mind, and I said to myself, "She has been anxious about him," and I wondered how that love would end. When I had come home from Cadiz while she was ill, I had often found Ada at work, and she had always put her work away, and I had never known what it was. Some of it now lay in a drawer near her, which was not quite closed. I did not open the drawer, but I still rather wondered what the work could be, for it was evidently nothing for herself. And I noticed, as I kissed my dear, that she lay with one hand under her pillow so that it was hidden. How much less amiable I must have been than they thought me, how much less amiable than I thought myself, to be so preoccupied with my own cheerfulness and contentment as to think that it only rested with me to put my dear girl right and set her mind at peace. But I lay down, self-deceived in that belief, and I awoke in it next day to find that there was still the same shade between me and my darling.
Chapter 51. Enlightened. When Mr. Woodcourt arrived in London, he went that very same day to Mr. Vholes's in Symond's Inn, for he never once, from the moment when I entreated him to be a friend to Richard, neglected or forgot his promise. He had told me that he accepted the charge as a sacred trust, and he was ever true to it in that spirit. He found Mr. Vholes in his office, and informed Mr. Vholes of his agreement with Richard that he should call there to learn his address.
"Just so, sir," said Mr. Vholes. "Mr. C.'s address is not 100 miles from here, sir. Mr. C.'s address is not 100 miles from here. Would you take a seat, sir?"
Mr. Woodcourt thanked Mr. Vholes, but he had no business with him beyond what he had mentioned.
"Just so, sir, I believe, sir," said Mr. Vholes, still quietly insisting on the seat by not giving the address, "that you have influence with Mr. C. Indeed, I'm aware that you have."
"I was not aware of it myself," returned Mr. Woodcourt, "but I suppose you know best."
"Sir," rejoined Mr. Vholes, self-contained as usual, voice and all, "it is a part of my professional duty to know best. It is a part of my professional duty to study and to understand a gentleman who confides his interests to me. In my professional duty I shall not be wanting, sir, if I know it. I may, with the best intentions, be wanting in it, without knowing it, but not if I know it, sir.
Mr. Woodcourt again mentioned the address.
Give me leave, sir, said Mr. Vholes. Bear with me for a moment. Sir, Mr. C. is playing for a considerable stake, and cannot play without, need I say what?
Money, I presume.
Sir, said Mr. Vholes, to be honest with you, honesty being my golden rule, whether I gain by it or lose, and I find that I generally lose, money is the word. Now, sir, upon the chances of Mr. C.'s game, I express to you no opinion. No opinion. It might be highly impolitic in Mr. C., after playing so long and so high, to leave off. It might be the reverse. I say nothing.
No, sir, said Mr. Vholes, bringing his hand flat down upon his desk in a positive manner.
Nothing.
You seem to forget, returned Mr. Woodcourt, that I ask you to say nothing and have no interest in anything you say.
Pardon me, sir, retorted Mr. Vholes. You do yourself an injustice. No, sir, pardon me. You shall not in my office, if I know it, do yourself an injustice. You are interested in anything and in everything that relates to your friend. I know human nature much better, sir, than to admit for an instant that a gentleman of your appearance is not interested in whatever concerns his friend.
Well, replied Mr. Woodcourt, that may be. I am particularly interested in his address.
The number, sir, said Mr. Vholes, parenthetically, I believe I have already mentioned. If Mr. C. is to continue to play for this considerable stake, sir, he must have funds. Understand me. There are funds in hand at present. I ask for nothing. There are funds in hand. But for the onward play, more funds must be provided. Unless Mr. C. is to throw away what he has already ventured, which is wholly and solely a point for his consideration. This, sir, I take the opportunity of stating openly to you as the friend of Mr. C. Without funds, I shall always be happy to appear and act for Mr. C. to the extent of all such costs as are safe to be allowed out of the estate. Not beyond that. I could not go beyond that, sir, without wronging someone. I must either wrong my three dear girls, or my venerable father, who is entirely dependent on me in the Vale of Taunton, or someone. Whereas, sir, my resolution is, call it weakness or folly, if you please, to wrong no one.
Mr. Woodcourt rather sternly rejoined that he was glad to hear it.
"I wish, sir," said Mr. Vholes, "to leave a good name behind me. Therefore I take every opportunity of openly stating to a friend of Mr. C. how Mr. C. is situated. As to myself, sir, the labourer is worthy of his hire. If I undertake to put my shoulder to the wheel, I do it. And I earn what I get. I am here for that purpose. My name is painted on the door outside with that object.
And Mr. Carstone's address, Mr. Vholes?
Sir, returned Mr. Vholes, as I believe I have already mentioned, it is next door. On the second story you will find Mr. C.'s apartments. Mr. C. desires to be near his professional adviser. And I am far from objecting, for I court inquiry.
Upon this, Mr. Woodcourt wished Mr. Vholes good day and went in search of Richard, the change in whose appearance he began to understand now but too well. He found him in a dull room, fadedly furnished, much as I had found him in his barrack room but a little while before, except that he was not writing but was sitting with a book before him, from which his eyes and thoughts were far astray. As the door chanced to be standing open, Mr. Woodcourt was in his presence for some moments without being perceived, and he told me that he never could forget the haggardness of his face and the dejection of his manner before he was aroused from his dream.
"Woodcourt, my dear fellow!" cried Richard, starting up with extended hands. "You come upon my vision like a ghost."
"A friendly one," he replied, "and only waiting, as they say ghosts do, to be addressed. How does the mortal world go?"
They were seated now, near together.
"Badly enough and slowly enough," said Richard, "speaking at least for my part of it."
"What part is that?"
"The Chancery part."
"I never heard," returned Mr. Woodcourt, shaking his head, "of its going well yet."
"Nor I," said Richard moodily. "Whoever did?"
He brightened again in a moment, and said with his natural openness,
"Woodcourt, I shall be sorry to be misunderstood by you, even if I gained by it in your estimation. You must know that I have done no good this long time. I have not intended to do much harm, but I seem to have been capable of nothing else. It may be that I should have done better by keeping out of the net into which my destiny has worked me, but I think not, though I dare say you will soon hear, if you have not already heard, a very different opinion. To make short of a long story, I'm afraid I have wanted an object, but I have an object now, or it has me, and it is too late to discuss it. Take me as I am, and make the best of me."
"A bargain," said Mr. Woodcourt. "Do as much by me in return."
"Oh, you," returned Richard, "you can pursue your art for its own sake, and can put your hand upon the plough and never turn, and can strike a purpose out of anything. You and I are very different creatures."
He spoke regretfully and lapsed for a moment into his weary condition.
"Well, well," he cried, shaking it off, "everything has an end. We shall see. So you will take me as I am and make the best of me?"
"Aye, indeed I will."
They shook hands upon it laughingly, but in deep earnestness. I can answer for one of them with my heart of hearts.
"You come as a godsend," said Richard, "for I have seen nobody here yet but Voles. Woodcourt, there is one subject I should like to mention, for once and for all, in the beginning of our treaty. You can hardly make the best of me if I don't. You know, I dare say, that I have an attachment to my cousin Ada?"
Mr. Woodcourt replied that I had hinted as much to him.
"Now pray," returned Richard, "don't think me a heap of selfishness. Don't suppose that I am splitting my head and half breaking my heart over this miserable chancery suit for my own rights and interests alone. Ada's are bound up with mine. They can't be separated. Voles works for both of us. Do think of that."
He was so very solicitous on this head that Mr. Woodcourt gave him the strongest assurances that he did him no injustice.
"You see," said Richard, with something pathetic in his manner of lingering on the point, though it was off-hand and unstudied. "To an upright fellow like you, bringing a friendly face like yours here, I cannot bear the thought of appearing selfish and mean. I want to see Ada righted, Woodcourt, as well as myself. I want to do my utmost to right her as well as myself. I venture what I can scrape together to extricate her as well as myself. Do, I beseech you, think of that."
Afterwards, when Mr. Woodcourt came to reflect on what had passed, he was so very much impressed by the strength of Richard's anxiety on this point that in telling me generally of his first visit to Simmons Inn, he particularly dwelt upon it. It revived a fear I had had before that my dear girl's little property would be absorbed by Mr. Voles, and that Richard's justification to himself would be sincerely this. It was just as I began to take care of Caddy that the interview took place, and I now return to the time when Caddy had recovered, and the shade was still between me and my darling. I proposed to Ada that morning that we should go and see Richard. It a little surprised me to find that she hesitated, and was not so radiantly willing as I had expected. "My dear," said I, "you have not had any difference with Richard since I have been so much away?" "No, Esther." "Not heard of him, perhaps?" said I. "Yes, I have heard of him," said Ada. Such tears in her eyes, and such love in her face! I could not make my darling out. "Should I go to Richard's by myself?" I said. "No, Ada thought I had better not go by myself." "Would she go with me?" "Yes, Ada thought she had better go with me."
"Should we go now?"
"Yes, let us go now." Well, I could not understand my darling, with the tears in her eyes and the love in her face. We were soon equipped and went out. It was a somber day, and drops of chill rain fell at intervals. It was one of those colourless days when everything looks heavy and harsh. The houses frowned at us, the dust rose at us, the smoke swooped at us. Nothing made any compromise about itself or wore a softened aspect.
I fancied my beautiful girl quite out of place in the rugged streets, and I thought there were more funerals passing along the dismal pavements than I had ever seen before. We had first to find out Simmons Inn. We were going to inquire in a shop when Ada said she thought it was near Chancery Lane. "We're not likely to be far out, my love, if we go in that direction," said I. So to Chancery Lane we went, and there, sure enough, we saw it written up, Simmons Inn. We had next to find out the number. "Or Mr. Vholes's office will do," I recollected, "for Mr. Vholes's office is next door." Upon which Ada said, "Perhaps that was Mr. Vholes's office in the corner there." And it really was. Then came the question, which of the two next doors? I was going for the one, and my darling was going for the other, and my darling was right again. So up we went to the second story, when we came to Richard's name in great white letters on a hearse-like panel. I should have knocked, but Ada said perhaps we had better turn the handle and go in. Thus we came to Richard, poring over a table covered with dusty bundles of papers, which seemed to me like dusty mirrors reflecting his own mind. Wherever I looked, I saw the ominous words that ran in it repeated, Jarndyce and Jarndyce. He received us very affectionately, and we sat down. "If you had come a little earlier," he said, "you would have found Woodcourt here. There never was such a good fellow as Woodcourt is. He finds time to look in between whiles, when anybody else with half his work to do would be thinking about not being able to come. And he is so cheery, so fresh, so sensible, so earnest, so everything that I am not, that the place brightens whenever he comes, and darkens whenever he goes again. God bless him," I thought, "for his truth to me." "He is not so sanguine, Ada," continued Richard, casting his dejected look over the bundles of papers, "as Vholes and I are usually. But he is only an outsider, and is not in the mysteries. We have gone into them, and he has not. He can't be expected to know much of such a labyrinth." As his look wandered over the papers again, and he passed his two hands over his head, I noticed how sunken and how large his eyes appeared, how dry his lips were, and how his fingernails were all bitten away. "Is this a healthy place to live in, Richard, do you think?" said I. "Why, my dear Minerva," answered Richard with his old gay laugh, "it is neither a rural nor a cheerful place, and when the sun shines here you may lay a pretty heavy wager that it is shining brightly in an open spot. But it's well enough for the time. It's near the offices and near Vholes." "Perhaps," I hinted, "a change from both?" "Might do me good," said Richard, forcing a laugh as he finished the sentence. "I shouldn't wonder. But it can only come in one way now. In one of two ways, I should rather say. Either the suit must be ended, Esther, or the suitor. But it shall be the suit, my dear girl, the suit, my dear girl." These latter words were addressed to Ada, who was sitting nearest to him. Her face being turned away from me and towards him, I could not see it. "We're doing very well," pursued Richard. "Vholes will tell you so. We're really spinning along. Ask Vholes. We're giving them no rest. Vholes knows all their windings and turnings, and we're upon them everywhere. And we have astonished them already. We shall rouse up that nest of sleepers, mark my words." His hopefulness had long been more painful to me than his despondency. It was so unlike hopefulness, had something so fierce in its determination to be it, was so hungry and eager, and yet so conscious of being forced and unsustainable, that it had long touched me to the heart. But the commentary upon it now indelibly written in his handsome face made it far more distressing than it used to be. I say indelibly, for I felt persuaded that if the fatal cause could have been forever terminated, according to his brightest visions, in that same hour, the traces of the premature anxiety, self-reproach, and disappointment it had occasioned him would have remained upon his features to the hour of his death. "The sight of our dear little woman," said Richard, Ada still remaining silent and quiet, "is so natural to me, and her compassionate face is so like the face of old days." "Ah, no, no," I smiled and shook my head. "So exactly like the face of old days," said Richard in his cordial voice, and taking my hand with a brotherly regard which nothing ever changed, "that I can't make pretences with her. I fluctuate a little, that's the truth. Sometimes I hope, my dear, and sometimes I don't quite despair, but nearly. I get," said Richard, relinquishing my hand gently and walking across the room, "so tired." He took a few turns up and down and sunk upon the sofa. "I get," he repeated gloomily, so tired. It is such weary, weary work." He was leaning on his arm, saying these words in a meditative voice, and looking at the ground, when my darling Rose put off her bonnet, kneeled down beside him with her golden hair falling like sunlight on his head, clasped her two arms round his neck, and turned her face to me. Oh, what a loving and devoted face I saw! "Esther, dear," she said very quietly, "I am not going home again." A light shone in upon me all at once. "Never any more. I am going to stay with my dear husband. We have been married above 2 months. Go home without me, my own Esther. I shall never go home any more." With those words, my darling drew his head down on her breast and held it there. And if ever in my life I saw a love that nothing but death could change, I saw it then before me. "Speak to Esther, my dearest," said Richard, breaking the silence presently. "Tell her how it was." I met her before she could come to me and folded her in my arms. We neither of us spoke, but with her cheek against my own I wanted to hear nothing. "My pet," said I, "my love, my poor, poor girl." I pitied her so much. I was very fond of Richard, but the impulse that I had upon me was to pity her so much. "Esther, will you forgive me? Will my cousin John forgive me?" "My dear," said I, "to doubt it for a moment is to do him a great wrong, and as to me..." Why, as to me, what had I to forgive? I dried my sobbing darling's eyes, and sat beside her on the sofa, and Richard sat on my other side. And while I was reminded of that so different night when they had first taken me into their confidence, and had gone on in their own wild, happy way, they told me between them how it was. "All I had was Richard's," Ada said, "and Richard would not take it, Esther, and what could I do but be his wife when I loved him dearly?" "And you were so fully and so kindly occupied, excellent Dame Durden," said Richard, "that how could we speak to you at such a time? And besides, it was not a long-considered step. We went out one morning and were married." "And when it was done, Esther," said my darling, "I was always thinking how to tell you, and what to do for the best. And sometimes I thought you ought to know it directly, and sometimes I thought you ought not to know it and keep it from my cousin John, and I could not tell what to do, and I fretted very much." How selfish I must have been not to have thought of this before. I don't know what I said now. I was so sorry. And yet I was so fond of them, and so glad that they were fond of me. I pitied them so much, and yet I felt a kind of pride in their loving one another. I never had experienced such painful and pleasurable emotion at one time, and in my own heart I did not know which predominated. But I was not there to darken their way. I did not do that. When I was less foolish and more composed, my darling took her wedding ring from her bosom and kissed it and put it on. Then I remembered last night, and told Richard that ever since her marriage she had worn it at night when there was no one to see. Then Ada blushingly asked me, "How did I know that, my dear?" Then I told Ada how I had seen her hand concealed under her pillow, and had little thought why, my dear. Then they began telling me how it was all over again, and I began to be sorry and glad again and foolish again, and to hide my plain old face as much as I could, lest I should put them out of heart. Thus the time went on until it became necessary for me to think of returning. When that time arrived it was the worst of all, for then my darling completely broke down. She clung round my neck, calling me by every dear name she could think of, and saying what should she do without me. Nor was Richard much better. And as for me, I should have been the worst of the three if I had not severely said to myself, "Now, Esther, if you do, I'll never speak to you again." "Why, I declare," said I, "I never saw such a wife. I don't think she loves her husband at all. Here, Richard, take my child, for goodness sake." But I held her tight all the while, and could have wept over her I don't know how long. "I give this dear young couple notice," said I, "that I am only going away to come back tomorrow, and that I shall be always coming backwards and forwards until Simmons Inn is tired of the sight of me. So I shall not say good-bye, Richard, for what would be the use of that, you know, when I am coming back so soon?" I had given my darling to him now, and I meant to go, but I lingered for one more look of the precious face, which it seemed to rive my heart to turn from. So I said, in a merry, bustling manner, that unless they gave me some encouragement to come back, I was not sure that I could take that liberty, upon which my dear girl looked up, faintly smiling through her tears, and I folded her lovely face between my hands, and gave it one last kiss, and laughed, and ran away. And when I got downstairs, oh, how I cried! It almost seemed to me that I had lost my Ada for ever. I was so lonely and so blank without her, and it was so desolate to be going home with no hope of seeing her there, that I could get no comfort for a little while as I walked up and down in a dim corner, sobbing and crying. I came to myself, by and by, after a little scolding, and took a coach home. The poor boy whom I had found at St. Albans had reappeared a short time before, and was lying at the point of death, indeed was then dead, though I did not know it. My guardian had gone out to inquire about him, and did not return to dinner. Being quite alone, I cried a little again, though on the whole I don't think I behaved so very, very ill. It was only natural that I should not be quite accustomed to the loss of my darling yet. 3 or 4 hours were not a long time after years, but my mind dwelt so much upon the uncongenial scene in which I had left her, and I pictured it as such an overshadowed, stony-hearted one, and I so longed to be near her and taking some sort of care of her, that I determined to go back in the evening only to look up at her windows. It was foolish, I dare say, but it did not then seem at all so to me, and it does not seem quite so even now. I took Charlie into my confidence, and we went out at dusk. It was dark when we came to the new, strange home of my dear girl, and there was a light behind the yellow blinds. We walked past cautiously 3 or 4 times, looking up, and narrowly missed encountering Mr. Vholes, who came out of his office while we were there and turned his head to look up, too, before going home. The sight of his lank, black figure and the lonesome air of that nook in the dark were favourable to the state of my mind. I thought of the youth and love and beauty of my dear girl, shut up in such an ill-assorted refuge, almost as if it were a cruel place. It was very solitary and very dull, and I did not doubt that I might safely steal upstairs. I left Charlie below and went up with a light foot, not distressed by any glare from the feeble oil lanterns on the way. I listened for a few moments, and in the musty, rotting silence of the house, believed that I could hear the murmur of their young voices. I put my lips to the hearse-like panel of the door as a kiss for my dear, and came quietly down again, thinking that one of these days I would confess to the visit. And it really did me good, for though nobody but Charlie and I knew anything about it, I somehow felt as if it had diminished the separation between Ada and me, and had brought us together again for those moments. I went back, not quite accustomed yet to the change, but all the better for that hovering about my darling. My guardian had come home, and was standing thoughtfully by the dark window. When I went in, his face cleared and he came to his seat, but he caught the light upon my face as I took mine.
"Little woman," said he, "you have been crying."
"Why, yes, guardian," said I. "I am afraid I have been, a little. Ada has been in such distress, and is so very sorry, guardian." I put my arm on the back of his chair, and I saw in his glance that my words and my look at her empty place had prepared him.
"Is she married, my dear?"
I told him all about it, and how her first entreaties had referred to his forgiveness.
"She has no need of it," said he. "Heaven bless her and her husband."
But just as my first impulse had been to pity her, so was his.
"Poor girl, poor girl. Poor Rick, poor Ada."
Neither of us spoke after that, until he said with a sigh,
"Well, well, my dear, Bleak House is thinning fast."
"But its mistress remains, guardian." Though I was timid about saying it, I ventured because of the sorrowful tone in which he had spoken. "She will do all she can to make it happy," said I.
"She will succeed, my love."
The letter had made no difference between us, except that the seat by his side had come to be mine. It made none now. He turned his old, bright, fatherly look upon me, laid his hand on my hand in his old way, and said again,
"She will succeed, my dear. Nevertheless, Bleak House is thinning fast, oh, little woman."
I was sorry presently that this was all we said about that. I was rather disappointed,
I feared I might not quite have been all I had meant to be since the letter and the answer. Chapter 52. Obstinacy. But one other day had intervened when, early in the morning as we were going to breakfast, Mr. Woodcourt came in haste with the astounding news that a terrible murder had been committed for which Mr. George had been apprehended and was in custody. When he told us that a large reward was offered by Sir Leicester Dedlock for the murderer's apprehension, I did not in my first consternation understand why, but a few more words explained to me that the murdered person was Sir Leicester's lawyer, and immediately my mother's dread of him rushed into my remembrance. This unforeseen and violent removal of one whom she had long watched and distrusted, and who had long watched and distrusted her, one for whom she could have had few intervals of kindness, always dreading in him a dangerous and secret enemy, appeared so awful that my first thoughts were of her. How appalling to hear of such a death and be able to feel no pity! How dreadful to remember, perhaps, that she had sometimes even wished the old man away who was so swiftly hurried out of life! Such crowding reflections, increasing the distress and fear I always felt when the name was mentioned, made me so agitated that I could scarcely hold my place at the table. I was quite unable to follow the conversation until I had had a little time to recover. But when I came to myself, and saw how shocked my guardian was, and found that they were earnestly speaking of the suspected man and recalling every favourable impression we had formed of him out of the good we had known of him, my interest and my fears were so strongly aroused in his behalf that I was quite set up again.
"Guardian, you don't think it possible that he is justly accused?"
"My dear, I can't think so. This man, whom we have seen so open-hearted and compassionate, who with the might of a giant has the gentleness of a child, who looks as brave a fellow as ever lived, and is so simple and quiet with it, this man justly accused of such a crime? I can't believe it. It's not that I don't, or I won't. I can't." "And I can't," said Mr. Woodcourt. "Still, whatever we believe or know of him, we had better not forget that some appearances are against him. He bore an animosity towards the deceased gentleman. He has openly mentioned it in many places. He is said to have expressed himself violently towards him, and he certainly did about him, to my knowledge. He admits that he was alone on the scene of the murder within a few minutes of its commission. I sincerely believe him to be as innocent of any participation in it as I am, but these are all reasons for suspicion falling upon him."
"True," said my guardian, and he added, turning to me, "it would be doing him a very bad service, my dear, to shut our eyes to the truth in any of these respects."
I felt, of course, that we must admit, not only to ourselves but to others, the full force of the circumstances against him. Yet I knew withal, I could not help saying, that their weight would not induce us to desert him in his need.
"Heaven forbid," returned my guardian. "We will stand by him, as he himself stood by the two poor creatures who are gone."
He meant Mr. Gridley and the boy, to both of whom Mr. George had given shelter. Mr. Woodcourt then told us that the trooper's man had been with him before day, after wandering through the streets all night like a distracted creature. That one of the trooper's first anxieties was that we should not suppose him guilty, but he had charged his messenger to represent his perfect innocence with every solemn assurance he could send us. That Mr. Woodcourt had only quieted the man by undertaking to come to our house very early in the morning with these representations. He added that he was now upon his way to see the prisoner himself. My guardian said directly he would go too. Now, besides that I liked the retired soldier very much, and that he liked me, I had that secret interest in what had happened which was only known to my guardian. I felt as if it came close and near to me. It seemed to become personally important to myself that the truth should be discovered, and that no innocent people should be suspected, for suspicion, once run wild, might run wilder. In a word, I felt as if it were my duty and obligation to go with them. My guardian did not seek to dissuade me, and I went. It was a large prison, with many courts and passages so like one another and so uniformly paved, that I seemed to gain a new comprehension, as I passed along, of the fondness that solitary prisoners, shut up among the same staring walls from year to year, have had, as I have read, for a weed or a stray blade of grass. In an arched room by himself, like a cellar upstairs, with walls so glaringly white that they made the massive iron window bars and iron-bound door even more profoundly black than they were, we found the trooper standing in a corner. He had been sitting on a bench there and had risen when he heard the locks and bolts turn. When he saw us, He came forward a step with his usual heavy tread, and there stopped and made a slight bow. But as I still advanced, putting out my hand to him, he understood us in a moment.
"This is a load off my mind, I do assure you, miss and gentlemen," said he, saluting us with great heartiness and drawing a long breath. "And now I don't so much care how it ends."
He scarcely seemed to be the prisoner. What with his coolness and his soldierly bearing, he looked far more like the prison guard.
"This is even a rougher place than my gallery to receive a lady in," said Mr. George. "But I know Miss Summerson will make the best of it."
As he handed me to the bench on which he had been sitting, I sat down, which seemed to give him great satisfaction.
"Well, thank you, miss," said he.
"Now, George," observed my guardian, "as we require no new assurances on your part, so I believe we need give you none on ours."
"Not at all, sir. I thank you with all my heart. If I was not innocent of this crime, I couldn't look at you and keep my secret to myself under the condescension of the present visit. I feel the present visit very much. I'm not one of the eloquent sort, but I feel it, Miss Summerson and gentlemen, deeply."
He laid his hand for a moment on his broad chest and bent his head to us. Although he squared himself again directly, he expressed a great amount of natural emotion by these simple means.
"First," said my guardian, "can we do anything for your personal comfort, George?"
"For which, sir?"
he inquired, clearing his throat. "For your personal comfort. Is there anything you want that would lessen the hardship of this confinement?"
"Well, sir,"
replied George, after a little cogitation,
"I'm equally obliged to you, but tobacco being against the rules, I can't say that there is."
"You will think of many little things, perhaps, by and by. Whenever you do, George, let us know."
"Thank you, sir. Howsoever,"
observed Mr. George with one of his sunburnt smiles,
"a man who has been knocking about the world in a vagabond kind of a way as long as I have gets on well enough in a place like the present, so far as that goes."
"Next, as to your case," observed my guardian.
"Exactly so, sir,"
returned Mr. George, holding his arms upon his breast with perfect self-possession and a little curiosity.
"How does it stand now?"
"Why, sir, it is under remand at present. Bucket gives me to understand that he will probably apply for a series of remands from time to time until the case is more complete. How it is to be made more complete, I don't myself see, but I dare say Bucket will manage it somehow."
"Why, heaven save us, man," exclaimed my guardian, surprised into his old oddity and vehemence. "You talk of yourself as if you were somebody else."
"No offence, sir,"
said Mr. George.
"I'm very sensible of your kindness, but I don't see how an innocent man is to make up his mind to this kind of thing without knocking his head against the walls, unless he takes it in that point of view."
"That is true enough to a certain extent," returned my guardian, softened. "But, my good fellow, even an innocent man must take ordinary precautions to defend himself."
"Certainly, sir, and I have done so. I have stated to the magistrates, 'Gentlemen, I am as innocent of this charge as yourselves. What has been stated against me in the way of facts is perfectly true. I know no more about it.' I intend to continue stating that, sir. What more can I do? It's the truth."
"But the mere truth won't do," rejoined my guardian.
"Won't it indeed, sir? Rather a bad lookout for me,"
Mr. George good-humouredly observed.
"You must have a lawyer," pursued my guardian. "We must engage a good one for you."
"I ask your pardon, sir,"
said Mr. George, with a step backwards.
"I'm equally obliged, but I must decidedly beg to be excused from anything of that sort."
"You won't have a lawyer?"
"No, sir."
Mr. George shook his head in the most emphatic manner.
"I thank you all the same, sir, but no lawyer."
"Why not?"
"I don't take kindly to the breed,"
said Mr. George.
"Gridley didn't. And if you'll excuse my saying so much, I should hardly have thought you did yourself, sir."
"That's equity," my guardian explained, a little at a loss. "That's equity, George."
Unfolding his arms and changing his position, he stood with one massive hand upon the table and the other on his hip, as complete a picture of a man who was not to be moved from a fixed purpose as ever I saw. It was in vain that we all three talked to him and endeavoured to persuade him. He listened with that gentleness which went so well with his bluff bearing, but was evidently no more shaken by our representations than his place of confinement was.
"Pray think once more, Mr. George," said I. "Have you no wish in reference to your case?"
"I certainly could wish it to be tried, miss," he returned, "by court-martial. But that is out of the question, as I'm well aware." "'If you'll be so good as to favour me with your attention for a couple of minutes, miss, not more, "'I'll endeavour to explain myself as clearly as I can.'
"'He looked at us all three in turn, "'shook his head a little as if he were adjusting it "'in the stock and collar of a tight uniform, "'and after a moment's reflection went on.
"'You see, miss, I've been handcuffed and taken into custody and brought here. "'I'm a marked and disgraced man, and here I am. "'A shooting gallery is rummaged, high and low, by bucket.' Such property as I have, 'tis small, is turned this way and that till it don't know itself. And, as aforesaid, here I am. I don't particular complain of that, though I am in these present quarters through no immediately preceding fault of mine. I can very well understand that if I hadn't gone into the vagabond way in my youth, this wouldn't have happened. It has happened. Then comes the question how to meet it.
He rubbed his swarthy forehead for a moment, with a good-humoured look, and said apologetically,
"'I'm such a short-winded talker that I must think a bit.'
Having thought a bit, he looked up again and resumed.
"'How to meet it? Now, the unfortunate deceased was himself a lawyer, and had a pretty tight hold of me. I don't wish to rake up his ashes, but he had, what I should call, if he was living, a devil of a tight hold of me. I don't like his trade the better for that. If I'd kept clear of his trade, I should have kept outside this place. But that's not what I mean. Now, suppose I had killed him. Suppose I really had discharged into his body any one of those pistols recently fired off that Bucket has found at my place, and, dear me, might have found there any day since it has been my place. What should I have done as soon as I was hard and fast here? Got a lawyer.'
He stopped on hearing someone at the locks and bolts, and did not resume until the door had been opened and was shut again. For what purpose opened, I will mention presently.
"'I should have got a lawyer.' And he would have said, as I've often read in the newspapers, "'My client says nothing. My client reserves his defence. My client this, that, and t'other. Well, 'tis not the custom of that breed to go straight, according to my opinion, or to think that other men do. Say I am innocent, and I get a lawyer. He would be as likely to believe me guilty as not, perhaps more. What would he do, whether or not? Act as if I was? Shut my mouth up? Tell me not to commit myself, keep circumstances back, chop the evidence small, quibble and get me off, perhaps? But, Miss Summerson, do I care for getting off in that way? Or would I rather be hanged in my own way, if you'll excuse my mentioning anything so disagreeable to a lady?'
He had warmed into his subject now, and was under no further necessity to wait a bit.
"'I would rather be hanged in my own way, and I mean to be. I don't intend to say—'
Looking round upon us, with his powerful arms akimbo, and his dark eyebrows raised,
"'that I am more partial to being hanged than another man. What I say is, I must come off clear and full, or not at all. Therefore, when I hear stated against me what is true, I say it's true. And when they tell me, whatever you say will be used, I tell them I don't mind that. I mean it to be used. If they can't make me innocent out of the whole truth, they're not likely to do it out of anything less, or anything else. And if they are, it's worth nothing to me.'
Taking a pace or two over the stone floor, he came back to the table, and finished what he had to say.
"'Now thank you, miss and gentlemen both, many times for your attention, and many times more for your interest. That's the plain state of the matter as it points itself out to a mere trooper with a blunt broadsword kind of a mind. I've never done well in life beyond my duty as a soldier, and if the worst comes after all, I shall reap pretty much as I have sown. When I got over the first crash of being seized as a murderer— It didn't take a rover who is knocked about so much as myself so very long to recover from a crash. I work my way round to what you find me now. As such, I shall remain. No relations will be disgraced by me or made unhappy for me, and that's all I've got to say."
The door had been opened to admit another soldier-looking man of less prepossessing appearance at first sight, and a weather-tanned, bright-eyed, wholesome woman with a basket, who from her entrance had been exceedingly attentive to all Mr. George had said. Mr. George had received them with a familiar nod and a friendly look, but without any more particular greeting in the midst of his address. He now shook them cordially by the hand and said,
"'Miss Summerson and gentlemen, this is an old comrade of mine, Matthew Bagnet, and this is his wife, Mrs. Bagnet.'
Mr. Bagnet made us a stiff military bow, and Mrs. Bagnet dropped us a curtsy.
"'Really good friends of mine they are,' said Mr. George. "'It was at their house I was taken.'
"'With a second-hand violoncello,'
Mr. Bagnet put in, twitching his head angrily.
"'Of a good tone. For a friend. That money was no object to.'
"'Matt,' said Mr. George, "'you've heard pretty well all I've been saying to this lady and these two gentlemen. I know it meets your approval.
Mr. Bagnet, after considering, referred the point to his wife.
"Old girl," said he, "tell him, whether or not it meets my approval."
"Why, George," exclaimed Mrs. Bagnet, who had been unpacking her basket, in which there was a piece of cold pickled pork, a little tea and sugar, and a brown loaf. "You ought to know it, don't. You ought to know it's enough to drive a person wild to hear you. You won't be got off this way, and you won't be got off that way. What do you mean by such picking and choosing? It's stuff and nonsense, George."
"Don't be severe upon me and my misfortunes, Mrs. Bagnet," said the trooper lightly.
"Oh, bother your misfortunes," cried Mrs. Bagnet, "if they don't make you more reasonable than that comes to. I never was so ashamed in my life to hear a man talk folly as I have been to hear you talk this day to the present company. Lawyers? Why, what but too many cooks should hinder you from having a dozen lawyers if the gentleman recommended them to you?"
"This is a very sensible woman," said my guardian. "I hope you will persuade him, Mrs. Bagnet."
"Persuade him, sir?" she returned. "Lord bless you, no. You don't know George. Now, there." Mrs. Bagnet left her basket to point him out with both her bare brown hands. "There he stands, as self-willed and as determined a man in the wrong way as ever put a human creature under heaven out of patience. You could as soon take up and shoulder an 8-and-40-pounder by your own strength as turn that man when he has got a thing into his head and fixed it there. Why, don't I know him?" cried Mrs. Bagnet. "Don't I know you, George? You don't mean to set up for a new character with me after all these years, I hope?"
Her friendly indignation had an exemplary effect upon her husband, who shook his head at the trooper several times as a silent recommendation to him to yield. Between whiles Mrs. Bagnet looked at me, and I understood from the play of her eyes that she wished me to do something, though I did not comprehend what.
"But I've given up talking to you, old fella, years and years," said Mrs. Bagnet, as she blew a little dust off the pickled pork, looking at me again. "And when ladies and gentlemen know you as well as I do, they'll give up talking to you too. If you are not too headstrong to accept of a bit of dinner, here it is."
"I accept it with many thanks," returned the trooper.
"Do you, though, indeed?" said Mrs. Bagnet, continuing to grumble on good-humouredly. "I'm sure I'm surprised at that. I wonder you don't starve in your own way also. It would only be like you. Perhaps you'll set your mind upon that next."
Here she again looked at me, and I now perceived from her glances at the door and at me by turns that she wished us to retire and to await her following us outside the prison. Communicating this by similar means to my guardian and Mr. Woodcourt, I rose. "We hope you will think better of it, Mr. George," said I, "and we shall come to see you again, trusting to find you more reasonable."
"More grateful, Miss Summerson, you can't find me," he returned.
"But more persuadable we can, I hope," said I. "And let me entreat you to consider that the clearing up of this mystery and the discovery of the real perpetrator of this deed may be of the last importance to others besides yourself." He heard me respectfully, but without much heeding these words, which I spoke a little turned from him, already on my way to the door. He was observing, this they afterwards told me, my height and figure, which seemed to catch his attention all at once.
"'Tis curious," said he, "and yet I thought so at the time."
My guardian asked him what he meant.
"Why, sir,"
he answered,
"when my ill fortune took me to the dead man's staircase on the night of his murder, I saw a shape so like Miss Summerson's go by me in the dark that I had half a mind to speak to it."
For an instant I felt such a shudder as I never felt before or since, and hope I shall never feel again.
"It came downstairs as I went up," said the trooper, "and crossed the moonlighted window with a loose black mantle on. I noticed a deep fringe to it. However, it has nothing to do with the present subject, excepting that Miss Summerson looked so like it at the moment that it came into my head."
I cannot separate and define the feelings that arose in me after this. It is enough that the vague duty and obligation I had felt upon me from the first of following the investigation was, without my distinctly daring to ask myself any question, increased, and that I was indignantly sure of there being no possibility of a reason for my being afraid. We three went out of the prison and walked up and down at some short distance from the gate, which was in a retired place. We had not waited long when Mr. and Mrs. Bagnet came out too and quickly joined us. There was a tear in each of Mrs. Bagnet's eyes, and her face was flushed and hurried.
"I didn't let George see what I thought about it, you know, miss," was her first remark when she came up, "but he's in a bad way, poor old fellow."
"Not with care and prudence and good help," said my guardian.
"'A gentleman like you ought to know best, sir,' returned Mrs. Bagnet, hurriedly drying her eyes on the hem of her grey cloak. "'But I'm uneasy for him. He's been so careless and said so much that he never meant. The gentlemen of the juries might not understand him as Lignum and me do. And then such a number of circumstances have happened bad for him, and such a number of people will be brought forward to speak against him, and Bucket is so deep.'
"'With a second-hand violin cello, and said he played the fife, when a boy,'
Mr. Bagnet added with great solemnity. "'Now I tell you, miss,' said Mrs. Bagnet, "'and when I say miss, I mean all. Just come into the corner of the wall, and I'll tell you.' Mrs. Bagnet hurried us into a more secluded place, and was at first too breathless to proceed, occasioning Mr. Bagnet to say,
"'Old girl, tell him.'
"'Why then, miss,' the old girl proceeded, untying the strings of her bonnet for more air. "'You could as soon move Dover Castle as move George on this point, unless you had got a new power to move him with, and I have got it.'
"'You are a jewel of a woman,' said my guardian. "'Go on.'
"'Now, I tell you, miss,' she proceeded, clapping her hands in her hurry and agitation a dozen times in every sentence, "'that what he says concerning no relations is all bosh. They don't know of him, but he does know of them.' He has said more to me at odd times than to anybody else, and it weren't for nothing that he once spoke to my Woolwich about whitening and wrinkling mothers' heads. For £50 he had seen his mother that day. She's alive and must be brought here straight. Instantly Mrs. Bagnet put some pins into her mouth, and began pinning up her skirts all round a little higher than the level of her grey cloak, which she accomplished with surprising dispatch and dexterity. "Lignum," said Mrs. Bagnet, "you take care of the children, old man, and give me the umbrella. I'm away to Lincolnshire to bring that old lady here."
"But bless the woman," cried my guardian with his hand in his pocket. "How is she going? What money has she got?"
Mrs. Bagnet made another application to her skirts and brought forth a leathern purse in which she hastily counted over a few shillings, and which she then shut up with perfect satisfaction.
"Never you mind for me, miss. I'm a soldier's wife and accustomed to travel my own way. Lignum, old boy," kissing him, "one for yourself, three for the children. Now I'm away into Lincolnshire after George's mother."
And she actually set off, while we three stood looking at one another lost in amazement. She actually trudged away in her grey cloak at a sturdy pace, and turned the corner, and was gone.
"Mr. Bagnet," said my guardian, "do you mean to let her go in that way?"
"Can't help it," he returned. "Made her way home once, from another quarter of the world, with the same grey cloak, and same umbrella. Whatever the old girl says, do. Do it. Whenever the old girl says, 'I'll do it,' she does it."
"Then she is as honest and genuine as she looks," rejoined my guardian, "and it is impossible to say more for her."
"She's colour sergeant of the Nonpareil Battalion," said Mr. Bagnet,
looking at us over his shoulder as he went his way also,
"and there's not such another, but I never owned to it before her. Discipline must be maintained."
Chapter 53. The Track. Mr. Bucket and his fat forefinger are much in consultation together under existing circumstances. When Mr. Bucket has a matter of this pressing interest under his consideration, the fat forefinger seems to rise to the dignity of a familiar demon. He puts it to his ears, and it whispers information. He puts it to his lips, and it enjoins him to secrecy. He rubs it over his nose, and it sharpens his scent. He shakes it before a guilty man, and it charms him to his destruction. The augurs of the detective temple invariably predict that when Mr. Bucket and that finger are in much conference, a terrible avenger will be heard of before long. Otherwise, mildly studious in his observation of human nature, on the whole a benignant philosopher not disposed to be severe upon the follies of mankind, Mr. Bucket pervades a vast number of houses, and strolls about an infinity of streets, to outward appearance rather languishing for want of an object. He is in the friendliest condition towards his species, and will drink with most of them. He is free with his money, affable in his manners, innocent in his conversation. But through the placid stream of his life there glides an undercurrent of forefinger. Time and place cannot bind Mr. Bucket. Like man in the abstract, he is here today and gone tomorrow. But, very unlike man indeed, he is here again the next day. This evening he will be casually looking into the iron extinguishers at the door of Sir Leicester Dedlock's house in town. And tomorrow morning he will be walking on the leads at Chesney Wold, where erst the old man walked whose ghost is propitiated with 100 guineas. Drawers, desks,
pockets, all things belonging to him Mr. Bucket examines. A few hours afterwards, he and the Roman will be alone together comparing forefingers. It is likely that these occupations are irreconcilable with home enjoyment, but it is certain that Mr. Bucket at present does not go home, though in general he highly appreciates the society of Mrs. Bucket, a lady of a natural detective genius, which, if it had been improved by professional exercise, might have done great things, but which has paused at the level of a clever amateur. He holds himself aloof from that dear solace. Mrs. Bucket is dependent on their lodger, fortunately an amiable lady in whom she takes an interest, for companionship and conversation. A great crowd assembles in Lincoln's Inn Fields on the day of the funeral. Sir Leicester Dedlock attends the ceremony in person. Strictly speaking, there are only three other human followers, that is to say, Lord Doodle, William Buffy, and the debilitated cousin thrown in as a make-weight, but the amount of inconsolable carriages is immense. The peerage contributes more four-wheeled affliction than has ever been seen in that neighbourhood. Such is the assemblage of armorial bearings on coach panels that the Herald's College might be supposed to have lost its father and mother at a blow. The Duke of Foodle sends a splendid pile of dust and ashes, with silver wheel boxes, patent axles, all the last improvements, and three bereaved worms, 6 feet high, holding on behind in a bunch of woe. All the state coachmen in London seem plunged into mourning, and if that dead old man of the rusty garb be not beyond the taste in horseflesh, which appears impossible, it must be highly gratified this day. Quiet among the undertakers and the equipages and the calves of so many legs all steeped in grief, Mr. Bucket sits concealed in one of the inconsolable carriages, and at his ease surveys the crowd through the lattice blinds. He has a keen eye for a crowd, as for what not, and looking here and there, now from this side of the carriage, now from the other, now up at the house windows, now along the people's heads, nothing escapes him. "And there you are, my partner, eh?" says Mr. Bucket to himself, apostrophizing Mrs. Bucket, stationed by his favour on the steps of the deceased's house. "And so you are, and so you are. And very well indeed you are looking, Mrs. Bucket." The procession has not started yet, but is waiting for the cause of its assemblage to be brought out. Mr. Bucket, in the foremost emblazoned carriage, uses his two fat forefingers to hold the lattice a hair's breadth open while he looks. And it says a great deal for his attachment as a husband that he is still occupied with Mrs. B. "There you are, my partner, eh?" he murmuringly repeats. "And our lodger with you? I'm taking notice of you, Mrs. Bucket. I hope you're all right in your health, my dear." Not another word does Mr. Bucket say, but sits with most attentive eyes until the sacked depository of noble secrets is brought down. Where are all those secrets now? Does he keep them yet? Did they fly with him on that sudden journey? And until the procession moves, and Mr. Bucket's view is changed. After which he composes himself for an easy ride and takes note of the fittings of the carriage in case he should ever find such knowledge useful. Contrast enough between Mr. Tulkinghorn shut up in his dark carriage and Mr. Bucket shut up in his. Between the immeasurable track of space beyond the little wound that has thrown the one into the fixed sleep which jolts so heavily over the stones of the streets, and the narrow track of blood which keeps the other in the watchful state expressed in every hair of his head. But it is all one to both. Neither is troubled about that. Mr. Bucket sits out the procession in his own easy manner, and glides from the carriage when the opportunity he has settled with himself arrives. He makes for Sir Leicester Dedlock's, which is at present a sort of home to him, where he comes and goes as he likes at all hours, where he is always welcome and made much of, where he knows the whole establishment and walks in an atmosphere of mysterious greatness. No knocking or ringing for Mr. Bucket. He has caused himself to be provided with a key, and can pass in at his pleasure. As he is crossing the hall, Mercury informs him, "Here's another letter for you, Mr. Bucket, come by post," and gives it him. "Another one, eh?" says Mr. Bucket. If Mercury should chance to be possessed by any lingering curiosity as to Mr. Bucket's letters, that wary person is not the man to gratify it. Mr. Bucket looks at him as if his face were a vista of some miles in length, and he were leisurely contemplating the same. "Do you happen to carry a box?" says Mr. Bucket. Unfortunately, Mercury is no snuff-taker.
"'Could you fetch me a pinch from anywheres?' says Mr. Bucket. "'Thank ye. It don't matter what it is. I'm not particular as to the kind. Thank ye.'
Having leisurely helped himself from a canister borrowed from somebody downstairs for the purpose, and having made a considerable show of tasting it, first with one side of his nose and then with the other, Mr. Bucket, with much deliberation, pronounces it of the right sort, and goes on, letter in hand. Now, although Mr. Bucket walks upstairs to the little library within the larger one with the face of a man who receives some scores of letters every day, it happens that much correspondence is not incidental to his life. He is no great scribe, rather handling his pen like the pocket staff he carries about with him always convenient to his grasp, and discourages correspondence with himself in others as being too artless and direct a way of doing delicate business. Further, he often sees damaging letters produced in evidence, and has occasion to reflect that it was a green thing to write them. For these reasons, he has very little to do with letters, either as sender or receiver, and yet he has received a round half-dozen within the last 24 hours. "And this," says Mr. Bucket, spreading it out on the table, "is in the same hand, and consists of the same two words."
"What two words?"
He turns the key in the door, ungirdles his black pocket-book, book of fate to many, lays another letter by it, and reads, boldly written in each, "Lady Dedlock."
"Yes. Yes," says Mr. Bucket, "but I could have made the money without this anonymous information."
Having put the letters in his book of fate, and girdled it up again, he unlocks the door just in time to admit his dinner, which is brought upon a goodly tray with a decanter of sherry. Mr. Bucket frequently observes in friendly circles where there is no restraint that he likes a toothful of your fine old brown East India sherry better than anything you can offer him. Consequently, he fills and empties his glass with a smack of his lips and is proceeding with his refreshment when an idea enters his mind. Mr. Bucket softly opens the door of communication between that room and the next and looks in. The library is deserted, and the fire is sinking low. Mr. Bucket's eye, after taking a pigeon flight round the room, alights upon a table where letters are usually put as they arrive. Several letters for Celeste are upon it. Mr. Bucket draws near and examines the directions. "No," he says, "there's none in that hand. It's only me as is written to. I can break it to Celeste Dedlock, Baronet, tomorrow." With that he returns to finish his dinner with a good appetite, and after a light nap is summoned into the drawing-room. Sir Leicester has received him there, these several evenings past, to know whether he has anything to report. The debilitated cousin, much exhausted by the funeral, and Volumnia are in attendance. Mr. Bucket makes three distinctly different bows to these three people: a bow of homage to Sir Leicester, a bow of gallantry to Volumnia, and a bow of recognition to the debilitated cousin, to whom it airily says, "You are a swell about town, and you know me, and I know you." Having distributed these little specimens of his tact, Mr. Bucket rubs his hands.
"Have you anything new to communicate, officer?"
inquires Sir Leicester.
"Do you wish to hold any conversation with me in private?"
"Why, not tonight, Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet."
"Because my time," pursues Sir Leicester, "is wholly at your disposal, with a view to the vindication of the outraged majesty of the law."
Mr. Bucket coughs and glances at Volumnia, rouged and necklaced, as though he would respectfully observe, "I do assure you, you're a pretty creature. I've seen hundreds worse looking at your time of life, I have indeed." The fair Volumnia, not quite unconscious, perhaps, of the humanizing influence of her charms, pauses in the writing of cocked hat notes and meditatively adjusts the pearl necklace. Mr. Bucket prices that decoration in his mind and thinks it as likely as not that Volumnia is writing poetry.
"If I have not," pursues Sir Leicester, "in the most emphatic manner adjured you, officer, to exercise your utmost skill in this atrocious case, I particularly desire to take the present opportunity of rectifying any omission I may have made. Let no expense be a consideration. I am prepared to defray all charges. You can incur none in pursuit of the object you have undertaken that I shall hesitate for a moment to bear."
Mr. Bucket made Sir Leicester's bow again as a response to this liberality.
"My mind," Sir Leicester
adds with a generous warmth,
has not, as may be easily supposed, recovered its tone since the late diabolical occurrence. It is not likely ever to recover its tone, but it is full of indignation to-night after undergoing the ordeal of consigning to the tomb the remains of a faithful, a zealous, a devoted adherent.
Sir Leicester's voice trembles, and his grey hair stirs upon his head. Tears are in his eyes. The best part of his nature is aroused.
"I declare," he says, "I solemnly declare that until this crime is discovered and, in the course of justice, punished, I almost feel as if there were a stain upon my name. A gentleman who has devoted a large portion of his life to me, a gentleman who has devoted the last day of his life to me, a gentleman who has constantly